somebody came to my room yesterday. quite late. Unfortunately, I was not able to spend any time with her because I was just about to leave for a tutorial. But that person said that the sound level on the podcast was very quiet and it was difficult to hear. So I tested that out myself with a pair of just ordinary earbuds, you know, these things here. And if you plug this into your computer and listen to the podcast, then it comes through loud and clear. Although, if you just play it, certainly I tried playing it in my computer and that was indeed very quiet, but there's no problem if you use earplugs. So, let us move on to magnetics. We've just had 5 lectures on gravity. At this point, everybody should have read the gravity chapter in the textbook. If you've not read this chapter, then you should read it this week so that you consolidate the information in your minds. And we're now going to move on to magnetics, and you should be progressively reading the magnetics chapter as well. The more you read before the lectures, the more you'll understand the lectures. And what we're going to cover in the first lecture is just, again, the general overview of stuff, an introduction, talk about the Earth's main field. There are some quite interesting concepts here, rock magnetism and susceptibility, which are essentially susceptibilities, the equivalent of density in gravity. So magnetics is a little bit more complex, and that's why we do gravity first. So we're going to build on the concepts that you've acquired. So there are 3 fundamental differences with gravity. In the case of gravity, we can assume everything's working downwards. Because the Earth is so massive, it completely dominates everything else. So a bookcase or 50 students or whatever, the gravitational field due to those objects, pardon me calling you an object, is completely negligible compared with the planet that we're on, and so we can assume that gravity always points towards the Earth's centre of mass. However, you can't assume that in the case of magnetics. Yes, the Earth has a magnetic field, but if we took a strong magnet and we placed it on the desk in front here and then we took a compass, the compass would be significantly affected by the strong magnetic body, which could be very small, that was sitting on the desk here. So magnetic fields can point in any direction, up, down, whatever. Secondly, we have to assume that magnetic poles come in pairs, and for every positive pole, there's a negative pole, or if you like, for every south pole, there's a north pole. So if these poles are very far, a very large distance apart, supposing you have some kind of extremely long bar magnet and you're just examining what's going on at one end, then you can consider these to be single poles. But again, they could be repulsive or attractive. Okay? The Earth's gravity field is always attractive, but magnetic poles are not necessarily so. But usually you have to worry about the poles being quite close to one another. So for every positive pole, south pole if you like, you have to have an opposite pole which is balancing it. So if you're doing the calculations here, you want to derive the magnetic effect of a sphere or something rather like that, you can't assume that this sphere is just one attractive mass. You've got to assume that there are attractive parts of it and repulsive parts of it, and you have to calculate the effects of those and add them together. So you end up with much more complicated equations, and the way this pans out is that the interpretation is much more complicated than gravity. So if you feel that interpreting gravity anomalies is complicated, then it is as nothing compared with magnetic anomalies. And the third thing is that magnetism is dependent on mineralogy. To a first approximation, the magnetism of rocks is dependent on the amount of magnetite in them. So you've probably all heard of the mineral magnetite. So you could have a body of iron ore that had a lot of magnetite in it, and it would have a strong magnetic field. But you could have a body of iron ore which had got exactly the same amount of valuable ore in it, but it was not in the mineral magnetite, and then it would have a very weak magnetic field. So you can probably all immediately see a problem here. You go out and you do some magnetic surveying over an area where you know there are iron resources, might be valuable, and you know, you get some kind of magnetic map from that, and it's very, very difficult to translate that in terms of, you know, how much ore there is, how big the body is, and what it contains. So, you know, this is not the case with gravity. We can make rough guesses of tonnage with gravity, but you can't do that with magnetics so easily. However, it's not all bad news. The measurements are very simple to make. So those people who have already gone out and done some magnetic surveying up on the peninsula will see that it's not such a fiddle. You don't have to level the device, and it's quite simple. You just plonk yourself in the right position, press a button, and write the number down. And of course, with modern magnetometers, you don't even have to write the number down. So in theory, I guess people could do magnetic surveying completely illiterate. You wouldn't even need to be able to write, and you could still do it, because modern instruments will record the reading in their memories. So magnetics is the oldest type of geophysical surveying that was ever done. It's been done for several centuries. Of course, magnetics was always quite important because it was used by navigators. So of course it was instrumental in the Western civilization discovering the world and navigating across the seas. Nowadays it's of lesser importance. It's a secondary method, unless you have a particular specialist target. So if you're looking for hydrocarbons, you don't use magnetic surveying as your primary target. You might use it for very broad reconnaissance surveying, but once you've honed in on an interesting area, you wouldn't use magnetics. Obviously, you'd use seismic reflection surveying. However, magnetics is still used a lot, so there's masses and masses of magnetic data out there, because if you're going in a ship and you're surveying in a ship, or taking gravity measurements or something like that, it's really no extra effort to take magnetic measurements. So typically people come back from exploration expeditions or research cruises or something like that, and they've taken a lot of explosion data or whatever it is they're going after, dredging or whatever, and the ship has towed a magnetometer as well, because it doesn't cost anything more to do that. So you have this kind of additional data. So there's a tremendous lot of magnetic data out there, and you can do neat things with it very inexpensively that you can't do with other methods or would cost a tremendous lot more. These are some of the things it can be used for. So, it's quite versatile. It can be used for oil and minerals. You can calculate the depth to the basement, so that's quite an important one. Usually when we're interested in sedimentary basins that might be hydrocarbon bearing, so you might have a thickness of 2 or 3 or more kilometres of sediment, and underneath that you have basement material, metamorphic basement. And often we're interested in how thick these sediments are, because that tells us something about hydrocarbon potential. You know, if the sediment is only 100 metres thick, then there can't be too much there, but if it's 1 or 2 kilometres thick, then potentially there could be much more resource there. And magnetic surveying can very inexpensively tell you how deep the basin is, the basement, so that you can tell what the thickness of sediment above it is. Kimberlite pipes, geothermal energy, and it's used a lot in archaeology. So is that program Time Team still broadcast? Is it? Oh really? Which channel? I haven't
seen.
It's
called Quest Plus 7.
It's called what?
It's probably on a channel that no one watches.
It's not on a channel I watch, because I used to enjoy it, and it doesn't seem to be shown anymore. But Tony Moore used to be talking over these trenches, and talking to his archaeologists and say, maybe this Roman trench goes on in 100 yards. It says geophysit. He would say geophysit. So he would get some geophysics person in, and as far as he was concerned, this was just what he was interested in, was like something that looked like a map of what was under the ground at the end of the day. But it wasn't a particularly detailed explanation of the fact that they were generally using magnetics to do that. Maybe Tony doesn't know that. But some things do show up very brightly. You know, I've seen some archaeological magnetic maps, which are just completely unbelievable. I mean, you know, I've got a picture in one of these PowerPoints here of it just looks like a photograph of this great big Roman fort, and you can see the walls, you can see where trenches were dug, you can see where buildings are, you can see all sorts of things, even down to the level that you can double guess what the object is and what that building was used for. So it's a tremendously powerful tool in archaeology, and in particular you can learn a lot about an archaeological site without destroying it. So the trouble with archaeological investigations is that you're destroying the unique sample that you're looking at. You dig this all up and move stuff around, take the stones out and what have you, and the whole site is destroyed at the end of it. So archaeology tends not to be done in that manner anymore, and if you find a valuable site, you'll excavate just a part of it, a small part of it, and you'll leave the rest of it, which can be studied later when better techniques are available. So with geophysics, you can, of course, take a look at the whole site and choose which bit you dig up. Okay, basic concepts, moving on to the actual physics of it. So you may have done this sort of experiment in physics where you take a bar magnet, you stick it on top of a sheet of paper and you scatter iron filings around, give it a little shake like this, and the iron filings will line up in what's called lines of force. The convention is that the so-called north-seeking poles, so if you've got a compass, okay, the little needle points to the north pole, that needle is a north-seeking pole. The convention is that it's positive, that's just, you know, defined, and in actual fact it is a south pole, because obviously it's pointing towards the Earth's north pole, and therefore it must be a south pole. So, poles occur in pairs, as I said before. These are the basic parameters and variables that we need to have in mind. Magnetic force is the force between two poles. The intensity of induced magnetization is the strength of a field induced when a body is placed into it. So many minerals do not have intrinsic magnetization of their own. If you took a sample of this material and you went out into outer space, you would find it had no magnetic signal. You'd measure nothing. However, if it's here on Earth and it's sitting inside the Earth's magnetic field, magnetism is induced within it. So these bodies will be magnetic if they're sitting in a magnetic field, but they won't be otherwise. And this is called induced magnetization. This is very important, because it means a lot of geological objects will have a magnetic field and can be surveyed with magnetism, you know, whereas they don't actually, they're not kind of intrinsically magnetized themselves. Susceptibility is the degree to which a body can be magnetized, so that's density, if you like. And here are the units. Field strength, newtons per ampere meter, is the SI unit. 1 newton per ampere meter is a Tesla. And those of you who've done the magnetic surveying already know that what we wrote down, what we measured on the device, were nanoteslas, which are also called gammas. So when you're surveying, you're talking about gammas or nanoteslas if you want to be fancy on Sundays. So 1 nanotesla is 10 to the minus ninth of an SI unit. So, you know, it's kind of like a milligal. You've got to remember that it's the surveying unit, but it's not an SI unit. And the average strength of the Earth's field is about 50,000 nanoteslas here in Britain. It's different in other places. So when you press the button, those of you who went out and did some surveying, probably you got a number flashing up on the little console which was close to 50,000. Might have been 48,000 or something like that. So that immediately tells you that this instrument is measuring the total field. It's an absolute instrument. It's not like the relative gravimeter where you take a measurement somewhere else, you take a measurement in the second place and the difference is 5 gamma or something like that. You set it up, you press a button, and it gives you an absolute measurement. You know, in Britain, that's close to 50,000 nanoteslas of what the magnetic field is. Okay, just to emphasize the induced magnetization issue. So iron is a mineral, which is an element, of course. This is one of these materials which, if placed in a magnetic field, will produce its own magnetization. So you could have a piece of iron which is not magnetic, you know, if it was outside a field. You could take it to outer space, it would have no magnetic field, or you could put it in what's known as a spinner magnetometer, which basically spins it round and cancels out the Earth's field. It would have no magnetization. But if it's sitting here on the bench in front and it's in the Earth's magnetic field, then it will acquire magnetization. So let's move on to the Earth's field. Quite an interesting subject. About 99% of the Earth's field is internal. It's generated internally inside the planet. And 80% of it can be modelled as a single dipole in the centre of the Earth. The other 20% or so can be modelled as little subsidiary dipoles around the edge of the core. Of course, we know that the Earth's magnetic field is caused by convection in the Earth's liquid outer core. So the Earth's outer core is liquid, it's swirling around, and it's that swirling motion, that convection, which causes the Earth, you know, generates a magnetic field. So we're in an interesting situation here where, you know, you can set up a model involving these, you know, dipoles here and others scattered around, and you can fit the observations perfectly, but the model is complete nonsense. Okay? So this is a good example of how you can fit data with a hypothesis which is completely wrong, and that's, you know, part of the ambiguity problem, I suppose, but it's something to bear in mind when you're, you know, you're thinking about any kind of scientific data at all. You know, if somebody says, well, you know, I have this theory and it fits the observations, that is not proof that the theory is correct. The reason we know that these dipoles in the Earth's core cannot be the true reason why the planet has a magnetic field is because of the Curie temperature. So when rocks or any material at all is raised above a certain temperature, in the case of magnetite, that's about 575 degrees, roughly. When it's raised above a certain temperature, it will lose its magnetization. And we know that if you go down deep enough in the Earth, you know, if you go down below, okay, 578 I've got here, if you go down 5 to 10 kilometers, in the continents, we know that you reach a temperature which is higher than 578 degrees centigrade. So below about 10 kilometers, rocks do not have this kind of magnetization. So it was realized fairly early on that the, you know, the Earth's magnetic field could not be caused by dipoles in the Earth's center. Einstein recognized this, so he was not alone in that. And nobody really understood why the Earth had a magnetic field at all, because they didn't realize that the outer core was liquid. This was something that was discovered during the last century. So Einstein described, you know, explaining why the Earth had a magnetic field as one of the 5 most important unsolved problems in physics. So, of course, it's now solved. So, 99% is internal, caused by convection in the Earth's outer core. 1% is external, and it's caused by electric currents in the ionosphere, which are caused by the impingement of the effect of the sun and the moon. The sun has an 11-year periodicity, an 11-year sunspot periodicity, when it's action on the ionosphere varies. So this means that the Earth's magnetic field, this 1%, varies on an 11-year cycle. It also varies on a diurnal with a diurnal periodicity up to about 30 gamma. Obviously, position of the sun in the sky is varying. And also there's a monthly variation of up to about 2 gamma, which is caused by the motion of the moon. In addition to that, there are random variations caused by solar flares, and the Earth's magnetic field can leap up and down by thousands of gamma just on a very short time scale due to solar flares. So the further north you go, the further into the boreal zone you go, the more frequent there are solar flares and aurora borealis and that sort of thing, and the more times you'd have to abandon your magnetic surveying, because if you're trying to survey some target, the Earth's magnetic field is leaping up and down by thousands of gamma on a kind of minute-to-minute basis, then you just have to take the day off and go to the pub because you can't carry on working. Okay, once we've taken into account those particular sources, the rest of the Earth's magnetic field, a very small subsidiary amount of it, is due to geological bodies. And those are, of course, the ones that we're interested in, and these are the target of our surveying. So, if you like magnetic surveying because it's nice and relaxing, you don't have to, you know, you can go for a nice country walk and you don't have to worry too much about your height above sea level and problems like that. You know, you might decide you want to do magnetic surveying for your summer project. Okay, in that case, this is the kind of place where you would need to look for a target. You'd need to whip out a geological map of Britain, and you'd need to look and see where igneous bodies are, in particular dikes. We had one student who did a lot of surveying over the edge of a lava flow, which was near to where he lived. So he saved a lot of money by staying at home and going out every day, getting his mum to drive him out and doing magnetic surveying across the edge of this old lava flow. Faulted and folded sills, these would produce rather subtle signals. So if you wanted to go for some subtle body like that, you would have to check that there was in fact a measurable magnetic anomaly first, you know, that we could measure with the type of magnetometers we have in this department. So sometimes the signal is maybe even less than a gamma, and then you have to use a super accurate magnetometer to measure it. Lava flows, basic intrusions of any sort, metamorphic basement, ore bodies, archaeological targets. You can toddle across the road to the archaeology department and ask if they've got a target of interest. And you would be aware of the fact when you did your surveying that here we have the North Pole, which is pointing towards the Earth's rotation pole. But the magnetic pole is not in the same place as the rotation pole. In fact, there are quite a lot of North Poles that people have defined for different on different bases. The Earth's magnetic pole is usually some distance away from the rotation pole. It's not a long way away. It's generally in the region of the rotation pole, but it's not exactly in the same place. And the angle of declination defines the direction in which your compass needle will point. You know, that is different from geographic north, so to speak. The direction at which the field is dipping is called the angle of inclination. So you've got declination and inclination. Everybody should memorize those two words and know what each is so that you could reproduce this diagram if you were asked to do so. Okay, the Earth's main field, so declination is mapped out here. So when this was done, let me see now, this is 2005, so the Earth's magnetic pole was here, just over Antarctica. As I said earlier, magnetism has been measured for an awfully long time because it was important for navigation purposes. So here we've got a little animation which shows how the field has evolved from the late 1500s up to the present time. So this is 1630, and so you can see that it's varying quite a lot, and it's really quite surprising how much detail we have. You could also see that the location of the North Pole is wandering about. And here we have the total intensity of the field. This is quite interesting too. This is the 50,000 contour here. But this is a 25,000 contour here. So if you were measuring, you know, in South America, then the Earth's magnetic field would have only half the strength it does up here. In fact, you know, it varies quite a lot, and some people have even speculated that we may be experiencing a magnetic reversal at the present time. It'd be interesting to look into that and see the reasons why that is thought. And here we're looking at the how the total intensity is varying over the same period from 1500 and something or other to the present time. So down here in South America, let me see here now. Starts off about 30,000 gamma, and you can see this is the 25,000 gamma contour starting up. So it's in South America, the intensity of the field has, over the last two or three centuries, has dropped quite considerably. You know, it's dropped from sort of 35,000 gamma to about 25,000 gamma. So people think that there's a very rapid change in the geological, when I say rapid, I mean geologically. And we may be looking at a reversal going on. Okay. So, moving on to reversals. You've probably been taught about magnetic reversals, have you not, in previous modules? I can see one head nodding. Has only one person learnt about them? Two people, okay. So, you probably know that the Earth's magnetic field reverses on a geologically sudden basis. There's rather little evidence of igneous activity during these reversals. So of course this reversal timescale has been built up by looking at stacks of lava in places like Iceland, you know, where there's been continuous igneous activity just through millions of years, and you get a stack of lava flows, and you take little samples starting from the top and going all the way down, and then all of a sudden you come to a layer where the magnetic field is suddenly in the opposite direction. And there is a little bit of evidence for how this reversal goes on, but not very much, and obviously you have to do extremely careful sampling. The samples taken for this kind of work are, let me see now, they're kind of about 2 or 3 centimetres long and maybe 1 or 2 centimetres in diameter, little round plugs. If you go to you know, some igneous localities, you sometimes see, if you look around carefully, that there are kind of little holes in it, and you think, oh my goodness, what kind of a bug could have drilled a hole that size? You know, it must have been something huge. In fact, it was somebody, some geophysicist, who had come along with a drill and drilled a hole in the rock and taken a little plug-like sample out, and in order to do geomagnetic research on it. So, you know, if you're mapping an area where there are lots of lava flows, there is a question: how do you date these flows? If you want a chronology of your area, you've got to somehow put dates on these lava flows. And it's to do potassium argon dating or something like that is quite expensive. I don't know what it costs now, but when I did my PhD, it cost about £100 per date. And you may not be able to afford a lot of these, but you could take a simple drill out. You could take plugs from these lava flows, and you could just measure up in the lab what the direction of magnetization was. So in my field area, most of the my PhD field area was in Iceland, and most of the lavas that I was looking at were normally magnetized, and some of the deeper ones were reverse magnetized. So these deeper ones were older than 0.7 million years, because the last reversal occurred there. So then there was this kind of marker horizon, if you like. Couldn't necessarily see it with your eyes, but that was certainly one way in which the stratigraphy could be divided into two groups. So the reversal pattern seems to be pretty random. Nobody has been able to suggest any pattern in it. Sometimes the reversals are very, very short and rapid. It's happening repeatedly, and sometimes they're extremely long periods. The longest is known as the Cretaceous Quiet Period, which lasted for such a long time that it's very inconvenient to us, because if you want to study features which lie on the sea floor and were emplaced during the Cretaceous Quiet Zone, you cannot use paleomagnetism to study the chronology of their eruption, because it's all pointing in one direction. So, interestingly enough, the whole of the Emperor Hawaiian seamount chain lies in the Cretaceous Quiet Zone, and this doesn't help us to understand that volcanic chain. Anyway, of course, these reversals were very influential in people accepting continental drift hypothesis. People had worked out the chronology of the flipping of the Earth's field with time by looking at sequences of surface lavas. So you go somewhere like Iceland, take a whole lot of samples, and you compare those to potassium-argon dating, and you could say, okay, it was normal at this time, reversed at this time, normal at this time, reversed at this time, and so on and so forth. So there was an exact chronology of the times when the Earth's field reversed. And then people started taking measurements at sea, sailing along on research cruisers, towing magnetometers behind the ship, and they discovered that exactly the same pattern was apparent in a horizontal sense along the sea floor. So if you go from the mid-ocean ridge out into one of the plates, you see that the reversals, you know, if you assume that the sea floor is forming at a constant rate, then the reversals were exactly the same as what you saw from vertical sequences in the continents. So this just simply could not be a coincidence. And the only explanation for this was that the seafloor was progressively growing. So this was such a stunning observation that 95% of all Earth scientists suddenly went from not believing continental drift to believing it just essentially overnight. This was a radical revolution in the subject, and you have to wonder what people thought who had published dozens and dozens of papers explaining why continental drift could not occur, only to suddenly find that it was completely incontrovertible that it did occur. I haven't heard that people, geologists, were throwing themselves out of high-rise buildings, but some people must have thought that was a surprise. So why does the field reverse? That's kind of was a big problem, really, because people kind of felt they had to be able to model it. It's all very well to observe something, but you want to understand it theoretically too. You just don't want to be in the situation of saying, oh, we've got this magical thing happening where it's flipping from one position to another. So there was a big effort to model convection in the outer core to see if a reversal could be reproduced in a computer program. And it was considered to be a great triumph that was published in high-profile journals with drums and trumpets in 1995, when somebody used a Cray supercomputer and used several months of Cray supercomputer time to model an actual reversal. And these pictures were published. So if we consider the orange lines of force here to be the North Pole, and the middle one is showing the whole field going completely nuts, and at the end, when it's stabilised itself again, the North Pole is down at the other end of the planet. Of course, a Cray supercomputer then was that was considered to be the cat's whiskers of computers, but everybody who has a laptop in front of them now has got more computing power than a Cray supercomputer then. Interesting thought. Have a YouTube video. Okay, so this YouTube video shows this modelling of the reversal. So we have the blue is the North Pole. So this program's been run again, and somebody's produced this neat little movie of it. find all sorts of interesting stuff on YouTube. It's not just all pornography and people beheading people in the desert and stuff like that. You can learn something from it if you try hard enough. Okay, so just a last slide here to summarise the history. Okay, in before 1600, people thought the pole star was responsible for the magnetic field. So this theory was dumped in around about 1600 when people realised it was something to do with the Earth. People started doing little experiments in laboratories, realizing that materials had a magnetic field. In 1700, it was the theory was rejected that surface rock, you know, actual geological bodies caused the Earth's magnetic field, because it was observed that the field changed with time. So as people learned more about the field, they were able to eliminate some theories. So people didn't know what caused the Earth's magnetic field, but Halley was able to say it's not all due to geological bodies, because it changes with time and these bodies don't. So this is an example of how science should be done. Even if you don't know the answer to something, you can say this can be ruled out. And that is how science progresses. Science does not progress by saying, okay, you know, I've modelled these observations with this theory, and my model fits the observations exactly, therefore I've proved this theory is correct. That is not how science is done. Science is done by progressively ruling out possibilities, so the remaining basket of possibilities, gets smaller and smaller. Early in the 20th century, that's when Einstein said, you know, we still don't understand this. And in 1995, this reversal was modelled. So between, you know, kind of 1930s, people began to realise that the outer core was liquid, and then it was realised that, you know, this might be a possible way of generating the Earth's magnetic field. And then in 1995, it was actually modelled. So there we have some sort of theoretical confirmation that sort of convection can produce not only the magnetic field, but also this strange reversal behaviour that it shows, which is so convenient to geologists. So let's finish there and have a break. I hope people are gung-ho to go out and do the magnetic surveying. There was a little bit of a disinterest expressed amongst one or two people last week and going out and doing it. But it's important that everyone goes out and does it, and to that end I shall be taking a register to ensure that everybody does it. So if you want to go out on a nice day when you're not going to get freezing cold, you might like to go today. Who knows what the weather will be like next week. So, but before we do that, you can have a 15-minute break.